Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today's program is about anniversaries and memories. There is a downside to remembering anniversaries. Each year they are commemorated, fewer who lived at the time are alive, and eventually entire generations are no longer passed into history with the anniversaries. So with Pearl Harbor, 75 years ago yesterday, and the great Astoria fire today in 1922, which has been 94 years. To begin, One Astoria Witch, a memoriam to Joyce Vandervoort, which I wrote, and everything else on the program. Yesterday was the 75th anniversary of the Japanese air attack on Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, December 7th, 1941, a day President Franklin Roosevelt said would live in infamy, and which propelled the United States into the colossal slaughter of World War II that had started in 1939. The U.S. Navy's Pacific Ocean Fleet was virtually annihilated. 8 battleships and scores of auxiliary craft were sunk or heavily damaged, and at least 300 military aircraft. Nearly 3,000 people were killed in the attack, most of them military men, including 1,000 sailors who died aboard the battleship Arizona. More than 1,000 others were injured, civilians as well as soldiers, sailors, Marines, and airmen. One of the civilian victims was a 12-year-old girl who lived in Honolulu. She was knocked unconscious by concussion, from which she always believed was a bomb bursting over her head, but more likely were falling pieces from explosive artillery shells shot from ships at the swarms of Japanese bombers and fighters. When she regained consciousness in a Honolulu hospital, she had nearly total memory loss. She was evacuated to the U.S. mainland a few months later with her mother, leaving behind a stepfather who was in the Navy. She spent several years at a special school, relearning how to do almost everything, how to speak, how to eat, how to count, how to dress, even how to tie her shoes. She never quite regained how to read again. She lived to the age of 83. Her name was Joyce Vandervoort. She died on Thanksgiving Day, 2012, in Astoria, Oregon. She was born in Helena, Montana, in 1929, the year of the Wall Street crash that led to the Great Depression, and ironically died amidst this most recent economic catastrophe. She was married twice. The first ended in divorce, and she was widowed by the second. She had 4 children, all boys, several grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. One son died in childhood. 2 of her other sons died in middle age 8 years ago, within months of each other. She had lived in Astoria since 1966 in a large Victorian house on the hill above the riverside site of a former worker-owned plywood mill, now replaced by houses built around the mill pond. Her house is a cedar-sided working man's Victorian, as one of her descendants described it, the Gothic taken out and hardiness for coastal weather built into it. At least 4 generations of her family lived with her in the house. I had been her neighbor across the street for nearly 14 years. Her capacious old house, backdropped against the Columbia River, and a huge ancient spruce tree popular with bald eagles, dominated the views from my windows. She was the indisputable matriarch of our small neighborhood of late 19th and early 20th century houses. She was the queen bee around whom nearly everything and everybody seemed to somehow revolve, which included the several generations of her family and a vast and diverse assortment of friends. The house was generally busy as a hive with visitors. People in small trucks constantly brought wood for her stove. Others mowed the grassy knoll upon which the old house reigned over our smidgen of North Coast society. She was grandma to nearly everyone who knew her, and the one Astoria witch to her CB buddies. She was, in a very real sense, the glue that held our tiny community together. Despite her war-inflicted traumatic amnesia as a child, she had an ability to clearly remember much of her life, one of her granddaughters says. She was able to do so much, Just think how much she could have done if that had not happened. I often thought that Grandma and the old house ought to disincorporate together. In earlier times, the house might have been her pyre, which probably would have been fitting. It is impossible to know exactly how many millions of children were killed or injured during World War II. Entire families disappeared from history in the bombed cities and ravaged towns and villages of Europe and Asia. It was not so common for American children to have been casualties of the war. It was unusual for a young American girl to have been so directly and calamitously affected by an enemy air attack near her home, and her wounds were lifelong. She was only 12, a child non-combatant, but she was as much a veteran of World War II as anybody who actively fought or was a civilian victim. She was, most certainly, a Pearl Harbor survivor. And now, the great Astoria fire. Today, December 8th, is the 94th anniversary of the great Astoria fire. The fire started in the basement of a downtown pool hall around 2 a.m. the morning of December 8th, 1922, cause still unknown nearly a century later. By 11 o'clock that morning, the oldest town in the state of Oregon was only a bleak scar on the banks of the wide reaches of the Columbia, the Portland Telegram reported, with the heart of its business district wiped out and with part of the lower residence district in ashes, one of its leading citizens dead and many more seriously injured. The business district of Astoria burned up this morning, Astoria's Daily Toveri, the only newspaper in the city left unburned, said that afternoon. All 40 blocks of the business section of the city have been consumed by the conflagration. The city is now a smoldering heap of ruins from Exchange Street to the waterfront and from 7th Street to 17th Street. The fire spread under the streets, which in that section of the city were built on pilings, the Tovari reported. The fire broke to the surface in three or four different parts of the city, then spread rapidly in the face of a strong wind. The wooden buildings caught fire quickly and flamed up like tinder, spreading the fire from block to block in a few moments. And that was the Tavari. The city fire department could not stop the fire as it quickly spread from building to building. The Tavari reported that a call for help was sent to Portland, which sent a fireboat. Three fire trucks also arrived in good time from Portland, and other fire apparatus arrived on the afternoon train. The firefighters were at considerable disadvantage. The first major problem they encountered, which they must have long dreaded, was the city's plumbing system, which was little more than a medieval maze of wooden troughs, though most seemed to have been enclosed. But when firefighters depended upon a reliable water supply for their hoses, those water mains were part of the firestorm rather than its solution. And their hoses burst on the hot streets, which in most places were wooden planks nailed over wooden pilings. It should not be difficult to imagine how hard they must have worked to stop the fire. Every time they lost a street, they fought for the next one, breathing thick smoke, no respirators or face masks, burning up in sweat from the inferno, yet chilled by a cold night wind that fanned the fire. Block after block was rapidly consumed by flames, forcing firefighters to retreat as the fire irresistibly advanced. Firemen fought to save the City Hall and St. Mary's Hospital. Patients were removed to Astoria High School, Walter Matula wrote in the Astorian Budget, commemorating the fire's 25th anniversary in 1947. Where there was no water, dynamite was substituted. Hotels, dwellings, and street intersections went up, and the fire went on. The Great Astoria Fire was comparable in its local effect to the fires that swept through Rome, 64 AD, London, 1666, Chicago, 1871, and San Francisco, 1906. The fire burned for 22 hours, destroyed 32 blocks in the city's heart, and left at least 2,000 homeless. Three persons died, one possibly an unrelated suicide, and damages were estimated at nearly $30 million. Aid poured in from all over. Portland contributed $53,000, and Victor Astor in New York heir of John Jacob Astor, whose explorer Pelt Hunters founded Astoria in 1811, contributed $5,000, a paltry sum considering his heritage and legacy. Matto wrote that by 1922, Astoria was an out-of-date city of deteriorating wooden buildings. Its waterfront had been built up for making money and handling grain, shanghaiing, and fleecing its large male population of seamen, fishermen, and loggers. This waterfront empire was dying. The town still retained the name of a wide-open hangout, but the money in crime was gone. So was the big shipping of the 1870s and 80s. The cannery empire was past its prime. The Chinese and Hindus employed in the canneries and mills were gone and left behind their combustible shacks. And that was Matula. The fire raged all day. The fire kept on coming, north, south, east, and west, often breaking out far ahead of the cauldron at the heart of the doomed city, Matula wrote in his anniversary article. Power failed, gas mains burst and blazed, cars, trucks, wheelbarrows, stooped backs, and held out arms carried away goods from stores. Stacks of office furniture, phonographs, records boxes, and bundles of articles, fur coats, dishes, lodge paraphernalia, all the goods of the city were heaped back of the fire. They had to be moved again as the fire advanced. Looters snatched goods, broke into stores, and carried off stocks in the guise of helping out. It was bright as day in Astoria, Matula wrote, except in basements, inner rooms, and where smoke rolled thick. Headlines in Oregon newspapers that day told the story. Astoria's heart in ruins. City destroyed by flames. Fire raises 35 blocks. Astoria business district destroyed. Telephone girls stick until flames reach building. Stores and offices in fiery pile. Astoria swept by greatest conflagration in Northwest history. Among buildings razed by the mad sweep of flames, as the Portland Telegram put it, Weinhardt Hotel, Beehive Department Store, Hafer Confectionery, J.C. Penney Store, Astoria Budget Newspaper Plant, Astoria Theater, Oddfellow Hall, First National Bank, Astoria Savings Bank, Western Union Telegraph Office, Merwin Hotel, Staples Motor Company, Elks Club, Astoria National Bank, Columbia Trust and Savings Company, Bank of Commerce, Scale Rude's Dry Goods Store, Astoria Drug Store, Central Drug Store, Dayton Drug Store, Owl Drug Store, Allen and Lewis Wholesale Grocery, Mason Ehrman Wholesale Grocery, Blue Mouse Theater, Liberty Theater, Star Theater, YWCA Building, Astoria Business College, Morning Astorian, North Star Hotel, Troy Laundry, Astoria Opera House, Methodist Church, Baptist Church, Central Fire Station. Matula named a few of the Astoria firemen who fought the big fire. Mel Grimberg, Otto K. Banksund, Dobie Banklund, Osmanula, Henry Jorgensen, Tiny Arrigono, Clarence McCoy, Dutch McCroskey, Frank Smart, Paul Kearney, Fred Lazel, Tony Antioch, Tim Aldridge, Harry Yeager, Fred Lazeman, Arvid Heinonen, Jack Cochran, Victor Aulin, Sam Berg, Al Graykin, Leo Fernie, Al Davis, Jimmy Coffin, Walter Christofferson, Joe Schamberger, Wayne Osterby, and Fire Chief Charles Foster, veteran of the 1883 fire that also gutted Astoria's heart, and newly elected vice president of the Pacific Coast Fire Chiefs Association. The three who died were Nora Staples, president of the Bank of Commerce and owner of Staples Motor Company, who dropped dead of a heart attack pushing a car to safety. Jack Cornelison, a deckhand aboard the tugboat Oneonta, who fell into the river misjudging the distance to the 16th Street dock in the smoke, and a person identified by Matula as a logger whose body was found hanging the next morning under the Sanborn dock. Although this man's suicide has been historically regarded as unrelated to the fire, and there seems to be little official curiosity about his identity, a question might be asked if he killed himself for being responsible for the fire's as yet unknown origins. By 6 a.m., All of Astoria that once stood on stilts over the river was burning, Matula wrote. From then on, the fire was gradually put under control with some losses. Late in the day, snow fell over the black ruins of the old Astoria, but melted in the embers that glowed for weeks while the new Astoria was born. Astorians, all of them, as if their spirits had been tempered in fire, took on the task of rebuilding their city. In the blackest hour of destruction, there was no wailing voice of defeat. The Portland Telegram said the same thing later that same day. Astoria is calmly listing its losses and already thinking how it will rebuild. The Telegram said in its lead article on page one that probably a total of 32 blocks in the retail heart of the city were destroyed beyond repair, and around this is a fringe of partly damaged buildings, many of which will have to be torn down. At the end of the day, Astoria's heart was a smoldering ruin or had dropped into the river and sizzled. Three people were dead, hundreds homeless. Astoria City Hall on the east end of the city survived, but the fire killed it as the center of municipal administration. A decade later, the city discarded it for a downtown bank building built since the fire. The old city hall is now the Heritage Museum of Clatsop County Historical Society. Before the fire, the deteriorating downtown was slowly being abandoned by business and politics eastward to a newer section of the city. The fire altered that migration, and the city center was resurrected on the ruins, similar to the regrowth of forests after fire. Compared to its abundance of 19th century hillside dwellings, downtown Astoria is relatively young, most of it having been reconstructed from the ruins of the Great Astoria Fire. Though the city repaired itself, substituting landfill for flammable pilings and piers along the riverfront, the boom days had long been over before the fire and they never came back. Fishing had already fallen off its peak before the fire, and the big trees nearly logged off from the surrounding forests. Astoria's prominence as a port city diminished, becoming hardly more than a parking lot for ships awaiting the large ports upriver. Not quite Walter Matula's vision of a city reborn from the flames, Astoria is in search of another renewal through salvage of its despoiled past. Old Astoria is the engine that drives present-day Astoria, manipulated by a self-promoting tourist industry that scrubs out the grime of the city's reckless history to display a Disneyland-like gay 90s fantasy while advertising Astoria as a museum without walls. The big fire of 1922, the fault line of Astoria's history, separating in public memory the boom times from the insipid, might realistically and perhaps metaphorically be called the city's high water mark. And that was the Great Astoria Fire. And a note, Catholic lay sister Pat McCann, who was a KMUN programmer and cared for elderly people even when she was old, would have celebrated her birthday yesterday, December 7th. She died a few years ago in her 80s. Her program consisted of recordings she made of elderly Astorians that she hoped would be preserved for posterity. Instead, she lost them all when an arsonist set fire to her home in the summer of 1989 during a rain of firestorms caused by a young man who attempted to incinerate Astoria a third time. The first was in 1883, which also burned the city core, as did the 1922 fire. The young man who terrorized the city with his matchbook turned out to be the son of a fireman who apparently abused him as a boy. He initially set fire to his hometown of Longview, Washington, in a first surge of revenge against his father. After a prison term, he drifted downriver and began a seven-month-long incendiary terrorism against Astoria. It seemed that every siren during those months evoked a pervasive silence that heightened the echoing shriek of ambulance, police car, or fire truck. Each time it was as if the city held its collective breath and only the siren was palpable, until it stopped, like Nazi buzz bombs of World War II that augured death and destruction when their motors suddenly cut off and they fell onto whatever and whoever was haplessly underneath them. A letter to the Daily Astorian vividly illuminates those months of terror. Who is trying to kill us? Why all a fire? We are like guards in our own home, afraid to sleep, weary at work, afraid to go anywhere, hoping we have a home to come back to. Sister Pat's house was the last he torched. He was caught and arrested after setting fire to her house a second time. An old house I lived in on Bond Street burned that year, but not by him. An upstairs tenant caused the fire when he fell asleep with a lighted cigarette, the first of his two cremations, and the first of my two evictions from Astoria residences. And now, Spastic Power, Arthur Honeyman, which, again, I wrote. Arthur Honeyman, one of the most famous and notorious Oregonians in the state's history, died on this date 8 years ago, December 8, 2008, at the age of 68. He was born on May 10, 1940, with cerebral palsy and spent his life overcoming personal handicaps and social restrictions and prejudice. His adult life was spent in combat for the rights of physically handicapped, and he gained wide renown for his invincible spirit and tenacious panache. He was a teacher, poet, and writer, author of the award-winning Sam and His Cart and several other books, essays, and collections of his poetry. He was co-founder of Wheel Press. He had a Bachelor's of Science degree in History and a Master of Arts in English, both from Portland State University. He wrote of himself, "I am a spastic. I was born with cerebral palsy. I am a freak. My body shakes like four winds tearing at it from all points of the compass. My speech is tortured, almost to being incomprehensible. I drool and vomit almost uncontrollably. I can't even write without laboriously dictating to someone. I also cannot eat unless someone feeds me. To go to the bathroom, someone has to take me, put me on the toilet, and wait until I'm finished. I have to be undressed for bed and dressed the next day for work and school. I am an adult and have to be cared for like a six-month-old baby." He used to have an old Peanuts cartoon panel tacked to his wall. Charlie Brown shouts, "My mind is at war with my body." But his mind was free, he wrote. He was a writer and scholar as well as a poet and a teacher. One noted class he taught at Portland State for a number of years was The Grotesque in Literature, from Grendel to Quasimodo to Frankenstein. He wrote a series of books, illustrated by Astoria artist Michael DeWade, which were thinly disguised autobiographical accounts of growing up with cerebral palsy. The first book, Sam and His Cart, was made into a movie, and a 2007 film, The Music Within, features an actor playing him as a leading character. He had been a member of the Oregon Commission for the Handicapped and unsuccessfully campaigned twice for the state legislature. He traveled extensively throughout the United States, alone or accompanied. He and his former wife, Joanne, created Wheel Press to publish his books of prose and poetry. He also wrote for a number of periodicals, including the North Coast Times Eagle. He was familiar in his homemade cart his father constructed when he was a boy, and well regarded for its sign in front, "Spastic Power is Irrational, but so is Love." He managed a very public trek along I-5 several years ago from Portland to Salem in his cart, which he propelled with his feet. A compelling newspaper photograph was made of him as police prepared to haul him away under arrest during a protest demonstration at Trojan Nuclear Power Plant, one of several he participated in, which in addition to his writings helped to eventually close the facility. In 1981, he was hospitalized because his incessant spasticating had built up calculus in his neck and pinched off his spinal cord, paralyzing him until surgery reopened the channel. While abed as a patient, he received hundreds of cards, letters, and telephone calls from friends and strangers who said he had been of enormous inspiration for them and hoped their prayers and goodwill would help him recover. He wrote in an article published in the North Coast Times Eagle that, "Throughout the ages, a person with cerebral palsy has been treated more as an animal than as a person. In ancient Greece, for instance, CPs were thrown over cliffs to their deaths because of their uselessness, as were all physical cripples. During the Middle Ages, they were locked away in dark pits along with the mentally insane. Renaissance period artists depicted them as creatures in their works. In the late 19th century, CPs were confined to rooms and were more or less a thing nobody talked about. It has not been until recently that CPs were allowed out into the streets to intermingle in society," he wrote. "CPs are much better off than they have ever been, and the future looks brighter than the present. The promise that modern technology and medicine might come upon at least a partial cure has become more likely. More than that, the public is becoming more aware and more understanding of the problems of cerebral palsy, which means CPs can hope for a more pleasant future." He collapsed while visiting friends on Whidbey Island in Puget Island a week before his death. He was life-flighted to Harborview Hospital in Seattle, where he died without regaining consciousness. Arthur Honeyman led a remarkable and indomitable life, filled with good humor and laughter, which benefited many thousands of others, disabled and not. His passing has truly been the world's loss. And an epilogue. Duncan Law, who died at age 92 3 years ago in 2013, was one of Astoria's most notable personages. He was a highly intelligent and inventive person, particularly in marine fisheries and resources. I introduced him and Arthur Honeyman quite by chance in Portland in the year 2000 in a Chinese grocery in Arthur's neighborhood. I regard that introduction as a convergence of two especially remarkable human beings I have been fortunate to know. I would not have been more pleased than if I had introduced Albert Einstein and Helen Keller. This has been Michael McCusker.